Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in British Studies. I'm Louise Mosqueta, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Padraic Scanlan about his new book, Freedom's Debtors, British Anti-Slavery in Sierra Leone in the Age of Revolution. Padraic Scanlan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
No problem. Padraic, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I was born in Montreal, in Canada, Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I did a BA at McGill, so a sort of hometown university, and then I did my PhD at Princeton. I finished that in late 2013. So I spent a couple of years as a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for History and Economics at Harvard, and now I'm assistant professor in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics and Political Science.
Right. And what attracted you to the topic of anti-slavery in Sierra Leone?
I mean, I've always been interested, I think, in the 1790s, in British history in particular, but I guess more broadly, a kind of global moment in the 1790s, this moment of profound transformation in political and economic and cultural history. And so I came into the PhD program thinking that I would do some kind of project related to the transformations in British society in that period. So I hopped from initially a project about the London Corresponding Society, so one of the most prominent radical, I guess you could call it an advocacy group at work at the time, to a kind of political biography of Hannah More, the Tory, the Tory radical, I think is the best way to describe her, but also in many ways a kind of radical feminist for her time. And then eventually onto anti-slavery. And so the project didn't really begin with Sierra Leone as much as it began with looking at the incredibly tangled and complicated history of where British anti-slavery came from, and the deep connections between what seems like, you know, on the face of it, a sort of progressive reform, you know, the end of slavery in the British Empire, but was in fact, in many ways, connected to a kind of profoundly reactionary current in British intellectual and cultural life at the time. So the project came from the 1790s, and it began as a British history, but then as I started to work on it, I saw an imperial dimension to it. And I think in the end, I thought, as I was writing the dissertation that eventually became the book, it would be important as a kind of counterpoint to see what happened in the empire after the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. But as the project developed, it became more and more about less and less a kind of point-counterpoint and more straightforwardly a history of the implementation of laws against the slave trade. So I think in the end, what started as a really domestic history ended up being, geographically at least, very much an imperial history.
And I mean your title, let's talk a little bit about your title, Freedom's Debtors. So who are those indebted to freedom? And what does it mean to be indebted to freedom?
So the central argument of the book is that in order to understand British anti-slavery in any kind of complete or significant or meaningful way, you need to understand what British anti-slavery did when it was put into force. And one of the main things that the abolition of the British slave trade in 1807 did in terms of actual consequences for British policy or for people within the British Empire was to act as the sort of opening for a campaign of interdiction against slave ships off the coast of West Africa. And for a significant portion of the time in which Britain prosecuted its campaign against the slave trade, many of the people, sorry, that's the baby in the background. Many of the people released by British cruisers from slave ships were repatriated in Britain's, at the time, tiny kind of backwater colony of Sierra Leone. And so the people who are indebted to freedom are the people who were initially known as, in British law, as captured Negroes, and then later as liberated Africans or as recaptives. So they, in the course of the 19th century, more than 80,000 people who were released from the slave trade by British ships and then repatriated in Sierra Leone. And the entire campaign against the slave trade and the entire premise of British anti-slavery was the expansion of freedom in the British Empire. So Britain was an empire of liberty. It was an empire, the first European empire, the first significant European empire to voluntarily give up its own slave trade. It had, in a sense, made a sort of sacrifice of a portion of its economy for the sake of human liberty. And so the question that was being worked out in practice in Sierra Leone was, well, what did it actually cost to increase the liberty of people released from the slave trade? What did those people owe to the British Empire in exchange for the sacrifice that Britain thought it had made? And so in practice, what happened was something that looked, I mean, look, it wasn't chattel slavery, but that was a kind of regime of coerced labor and of very intrusive social engineering that was built up as a kind of system for making the end of the slave trade worthwhile for Britain and to prove that what Britain had done had been worth it. And so freedom's debtors are the people released from the slave trade in Sierra Leone who found themselves, you know, taken from the decks of slave ships or the holds of slave ships to this complicated, ragged and I think very important system of labor and missionary work in Sierra Leone.
Mm. And you referred throughout your book to abolitionism as something quite distinct from abolition. What do you understand abolitionism to be?
So partly that's a way of thinking about, so I think it's worth making two distinctions. The first, and this is something that I've learned as I've, you know, I think readers of the book will see that I've borrowed a lot and thought a lot about the history of anti-slavery and of abolitionism in the Atlantic world more broadly. Mm-hmm. And I think readers will see that there's a lot of influence from American and African-American histories of emancipation in the way that I think about what freedom means and what the sequels to freedom in most of the Atlantic world ended up being. So it's important to distinguish, I think, first British abolitionism from American abolitionism, because British abolitionism was always a kind of much more imperial, much more conservative, and much more gradual version of abolitionism than what eventually emerged, you know, in the 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s in the United States, a kind of radical version of emancipation where the consequences of emancipation are not only freedom for enslaved people, but also full political rights for African American, or at least for African American men after emancipation. So it's important to distinguish that it's important to note that in the British Empire, the end of slavery basically never means the beginning of political rights and never really means the beginning of economic rights. The end of slavery is seen, whether it's in West Africa or in the West Indies in the 1830s, as the first step on a potentially, you know, indefinite road towards civilization. So that's the first distinction that's important to make. And the second is between abolitionism and abolition. And in a way that's kind of a sort of kind of cute sleight of hand to distinguish between domestic and imperial histories of freedom in the British Empire, because there's a really long and very rich political history, I think, of how abolitionism in Britain came to be. So how Britons who were sort of gung-ho slave traders circa 1700 came to think that the slave trade was not only morally wrong, but something that ought to be abolished by 1807. And that's a really profound sea change in British cultural and political life, but it really doesn't have much bearing on enslaved people. So there were no effectively no enslaved people in Britain in the 18th century. That isn't to say that enslaved people never entered into Britain. But for the most part, most people in Britain would not have seen, unless they traveled to the West Indies, would not have seen an enslaved person in the British Isles. And so in many ways, abolitionism was a kind of abstract debate within British society about what it meant to be British, what freedom meant within the British Empire, and what slavery meant to British political economy. And that's very different from the actual process of abolition. You don't have, you know, when it comes to debating the merits of ending the slave trade, you know, you have Edmund Burke, you have William Wilberforce, you have all these sort of towering orators of Parliament discussing the intricacies of British freedom. But when it comes to actually doing the abolition of the slave trade, once the decision had been taken, you have a very different cast of characters. In many ways, the sort of least of the British military sent to enforce a law that many people in Britain proper didn't really understand. So that's the distinction I want to make between the abstractions and the complexity of the politics of ending the slave trade as a political act and the actual doing of the abolition of the slave trade. And so my book, I think, is about abolition rather than about abolitionism, although it does necessarily redound back on what we ought to think as historians about abolitionism, having seen what it actually meant in practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Sierra Leone, the colonial history of Sierra Leone begins very much with the anti-slavery movement, with Wilberforce, right? So can you explain a little bit the short period when Sierra Leone was a private colony settled by these black loyalists from the American War of Independence, and what was the aim of this private colony?
So Sierra Leone began so Sierra Leone as part of a European empire, you know, passed from the Portuguese to the Spanish, and that was eventually sort of a kind of abandoned trading post on the coast of West Africa. And in 1787, so right after the American War of Independence, the prominent, quite eccentric British anti-slavery activist, Granville Sharpe, in many ways, one of the pillars of the history of abolitionism, because he was a lawyer and a kind of polymath political philosopher and political projector, devised a colony, which he called the Province of Freedom, which would be a place to experiment with. And this is something that isn't covered in the book, maybe as much as I'd like, although it has been covered by other historians. Granville Sharpe devised a colony that was based on old English principles of democratic governance. So he devised a constitution, a written constitution, that would divide colonists in the Province of Freedom into hundredors and tithingmen. So he reached back into this kind of Anglo-Saxon idea of a sort of neighborhood level democracy to create this government. And the people ended up being recruited to colonize the Province of Freedom, which was to be set up at Sierra Leone, were people who were known as the Black Poor. So these were indigent soldiers and sailors who had been left homeless and penniless by the end of the American War of Independence. And so that colony was founded in 1787 and collapsed fairly quickly. And many of the colonists fled, either some made their way back to England, but most sort of settled in other trading posts, often slave trading posts along the West African coast. And then in the 1790s, the Sierra Leone Company was formed. And the Sierra Leone Company was a joint stock company whose directors included many of the most prominent figures within elite British anti-slavery. So William Wilberforce was a director. Henry Thornton was a director. Many of the sort of leading lights of evangelicalism and I guess you could call it progressive evangelicalism in British, in Britain at the time, were directors of the Sierra Leone Company. And the company planned to resettle this trading post that Granville Sharp had attempted to settle in 1787 as a kind of pilot plant for free labor. So it would end up being a trading post where goods from West Africa that were not enslaved people would be sold by British merchants, and where eventually the company directors imagined African-American settlers from the British Empire could be sent to grow the kinds of crops that were grown so profitably by enslaved laborers in the Caribbean on the coast of West Africa. So rather than having enslaved workers growing sugar in Barbados or Jamaica, you could have free British African-American or free British subjects of African-American descent growing sugar on the coast of West Africa. And so in 1792, about 1,500 former, some free African-Americans, some formerly enslaved people who had been resettled after the American War of Independence in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, chose to go to Sierra Leone as colonists. And so from 1792 until 1808, the Sierra Leone Company were the nominal owners of the colony of Sierra Leone, and it was run as a kind of economic pilot plant. It wasn't particularly successful or particularly profitable, which had bearing on its later colonial history. But that was the idea. Sierra Leone was initially founded to make money through free labor, and to prove in a kind of geographically limited space the possibility of growing the kinds of things that enslaved people grew. But having them be grown by wage laborers instead of enslaved laborers.
Mm-hmm. And how did Sierra Leone in 1808 become a crown colony?
So the colony, as I've said, one of the big questions for the Sierra Leone Company, and one of the great what ifs from the perspective of the company directors, was, well, what if Sierra Leone had not been inadvertently drawn into the Napoleonic and the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. So in 1794, so just 2 years after the company, after the company had founded its colony with its new capital of Freetown, which is still the capital of independent Sierra Leone now. 2 years after the founding of Freetown, Freetown was sacked by French revolutionary sailors in 1794, and the company lost an enormous amount of money. So after that sacking of Freetown in 1794, the Sierra Leone Company was hemorrhaging capital. And the company's directors, who, as I mentioned earlier, were almost uniformly well-connected within British government, started to lobby for possibly turning over ownership of the colony to the crown. So rather than directly owning the colony and directly governing it, the company hoped that they could get the British crown to take over the colony as a possession, and then they could maintain commercial ties there. So that started in 1794. But the British government, the crown, was not particularly interested in taking possession of Sierra Leone. And what ended up drawing, I argue, in Freedom's Debtors, the company really into close association with the crown, was the arrival of the Maroons. So the Jamaican Maroons have their own incredibly complicated and interesting history, but the sort of thumbnail sketch is the Maroon community in Jamaica had lived independently of the plantation, of plantation power for centuries, in a uneasy truce, I guess you could call it, with plantation owners. So Maroons were guaranteed their freedom in exchange for returning runaways from plantations back to slave owners in Jamaica. And in 1797, the Maroons stopped effectively returning runaways, which led to the beginning of a war between the Maroons and the Jamaican government. And eventually a group of Maroons, this is a really convoluted story, but it shows, I think, the interconnectedness of the British Atlantic world at this time. Eventually a group of about 500 Maroons were just sent into exile as punishment for their involvement in the war against the Jamaican government. And they ended up, first of all, in Halifax, one of the same places where many of the African-American Black loyalists had ended up just a few years before. And eventually they ended up in Sierra Leone. And the Sierra Leone Company actively lobbied both the Nova Scotia governor, lieutenant governor at the time, and also the British central government for the to recruit the Maroons as colonists to Sierra Leone. And I argue in the book that they did that for two reasons. The first was to increase the military involvement in Sierra Leone in order to make Sierra Leone into not only a trading post, but also a military outpost of the British Empire. So the Maroons were considered to be both ferocious warriors in their own right, but also very dangerous. So they were themselves a military, considered to be a military fighting force, but they were also believed to necessitate having a British garrison in a particular place. So if you had Maroons in your settlement, you needed troops there to protect other colonists from the possibility of Maroon raiding. And so having the Maroons as colonists allowed the Sierra Leone Company to demand a garrison, and then eventually a Royal Navy, well, they wanted a squadron, but they got a single ship, but a Royal Navy presence in Sierra Leone. And that increased connections, sort of thickened the connections between the Sierra Leone Company and the British government. And the second reason was that the Maroons themselves were considered to be, in a way that the Black Loyalists were not, a kind of genuinely imperial group of subjects. So the British government didn't care particularly about the fate of the Black Loyalists, particularly by the 1790s, but it did care about the Maroons because Jamaica loomed so much larger in the eyes of the colonial office than did Sierra Leone. And so those two things, I argue, eventually tipped the scales in favor of turning Sierra Leone over to the crown. And that happened in 1808. And it happened, you know, just days before the imperial law against the slave trade went into force. But as I try to emphasize in the book, that was just a coincidence. Had they been able to do so, the company would have been happy to turn over the colony to the crown as early as the mid 1790s.
So the abolition of the Slave Trade Act. So this is a two-part question. What did it mean for the enslaved on their ships? So on these ships that were taking them along the Middle Passage, and what did it mean in practice for Sierra Leone in its early years?
So for people making the Middle Passage in the first, so in 1807, 1808, after the abolition of the slave trade came into force in the empire, the first people who were released from slave ships were, I mean, it's important to note that Sierra Leone wasn't particularly close to where most shipping of enslaved people took place. So by the turn of the 19th century, the vast majority of the slave trade was carried out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles to the south of Sierra Leone, particularly in the Bights of Benin and Biafra. So sort of just above and just below the equator, significantly, you know, quite far from Sierra Leone. So there was some slave trading that took place to the north of the colony and some to the south, in places like, well, what's now in what's now Senegal, to the north of Sierra Leone. But most of the slave trade took place took place further south. So many of the enslaved people who were repatriated in Sierra Leone, it's not as though they were caught right off the coast and then returned. They had already probably spent a significant amount of time on board a slave ship. And then when their ships were captured by British Navy cruisers at sea, they would then spend a significant amount of time on board either, you know, rather, you know, still on board a slave ship en route to Sierra Leone instead of en route to the West Indies, or on board a Royal Navy cruiser heading back to port. And then when they arrived in Sierra Leone, they would be, so at first there's a sort of period, there's a period in the history of the colony when no one really knew exactly what to do with enslaved people when they arrived. And so I point to that in the book as showing us something really important about what most people in the British Empire thought anti-slavery meant. So when people got to, when enslaved people arrived in Freetown in 1807 or 1808, they were taken off of the ship and brought to a part of the city that had once, that became known as the slave yard at the time, where they were effectively declared to be apprentices, and their apprenticeships were sold to colonists within the city. And it wasn't clear exactly what the terms of the apprenticeships were. It wasn't clear when they would end. It wasn't clear what colonists or British merchants could expect from apprentices or formerly enslaved people. And so at its very beginning, no one really knew what the end of the slave trade meant. The only thing that they really knew in Freetown was that it didn't mean that people released from slave ships were free to do whatever they liked. Many people actually, or at least there are anecdotes in the archive of former slaves arriving in Sierra Leone and realizing that they weren't particularly far from where they actually lived and wanting to return back to their villages. And not being allowed to do so because, you know, they might have been lying or at any rate, they had been released from slavery by the British Empire. And so they owed something to the British Empire before they could return home. So it was really fuzzy at first. But eventually the colony developed a much more sophisticated way of processing and of thinking about and of distributing the labor of former slaves.
And that's through the Vice Admiralty Courts, right?
So this is a point. I think it's one of the more important points in the book. So one of the most important figures in the history of abolitionism, of the judicial and legislative and theoretical crafting of British anti-slavery law is a man named James Stephen, who is the first of a line of Stephens who serve in the colonial office and eventually, you know, in the form of James Fitzjames Stephen, become sort of among the most important jurists in the British Empire. But James Stephen, the first one, James Stephen the father, is one of the architects of the 1807 Slave Trade Act. He's one of the authors of the bill. He writes the language. He's probably the most prominent lawyer in the anti-slavery movement, or at least in the elite anti-slavery movement in Britain. And so one of the central questions when so Wilberforce had started to try to pass resolutions against the slave trade early in the 1790s. And some of them passed and some of them failed. And after the beginning of the war with France, most of them failed. But those were more symbolic than practical motions against the slave trade. But when it became clear by the turn of the 19th century, and especially by 1804, 1805, that it would actually be legislatively possible to end the slave trade. A burning question for the abolitionist movement was how you would actually free people from slavery and what you would do with people freed from slave ships. So it's important to note that no one in the anti-slavery movement was thinking about the end of slavery at all. Which eventually happened in 1834 with the Emancipation Act, although that also was followed by a explicitly gradual system for teaching, I guess, the disciplines of freedom to formerly enslaved people. But no one in the anti-slavery movement thought that the end of the slave trade meant the end of slavery. The West Indies were just too important and too politically significant within the British Empire for that to be possible. You couldn't regulate Jamaica in the same way that you could regulate trade from Britain. And the slave trade was an imperial trade. It wasn't a West Indian trade. It was based largely in Britain. So the question was, what do you do with enslaved people after you free them from slave ships? And one thing that the abolitionists were desperate to avoid was that enslaved people would be turned over to West Indian planters, free or enslaved. And so the question was, how do you keep people from ending up in the West Indies? And how do you process so there was sort of one legislative problem was, how do you actually turn people over from slavery to freedom without them ending up in the hands of West Indian slave owners? And the second question was, how do you actually get people to chase slave ships? Because in the midst of the Napoleonic Wars, there were a lot. First of all, the British Navy was under significant strain in the midst of a global war with France. And more importantly, the way that naval warfare worked, particularly outside of really important zones of conflict. So if you have something like the Battle of the Saints, or the great kind of naval battles of ships of the line belonging to Britain and belonging to France fighting each other for control of a particular part of the ocean. So that was one way of organizing naval warfare, these kind of massed battles of fleet against fleet. But most naval conflict was organized in the British Empire in a kind of tournament system. So ships were allowed to cruise looking for enemy and neutral vessels, and they could basically kill whatever they killed, they got to eat, to use a kind of sort of crude metaphor for it. So they hunted for prizes, and so a ship would capture, say, if you were cruising off the coast of Barbados and you captured a French merchant ship, you could bring it back to Barbados, and an instrument called the Vice Admiralty Court would really quickly auction off the ship, all of its stuff, and give you a significant, the captain of the British ship, a significant chunk of the money. And it just so happened that James Stephen had began his legal career as an advocate in the Court of Vice Admiralty in Barbados. So he admired and was impressed by the speed at which captured shipping could be turned into money, which would then encourage captains to keep trying to capture more and more shipping. And so Stephen, after the passage of the 1807 Slave Trade Act, pushed really, really hard for the creation of a new Court of Vice Admiralty in Sierra Leone, which he felt, and most of the other abolitionist leaders, Wilberforce, Clarkson, by this time Zachary Macaulay, agreed that if the court was in Sierra Leone, it would, first of all, make sure that enslaved people from slave ships didn't end up in the West Indies, because they would end up in the hands of the new Crown Colony, which was still deeply connected to British anti-slavery. And at the same time, by turning slave ships into money, it would encourage Royal Navy captains who were cruising off West Africa to pursue slave ships rather than other kinds of shipping, which would accelerate the abolition of the slave trade. So the Vice Admiralty Court is an instrument that takes an idea that was developed in the course of a long series of 18th century wars, largely between Britain and France, and in many ways largely over the enormous riches of Caribbean shipping, and transports it to West Africa and repurposes it for slave trade interdiction. Sorry, this isn't really, this is really complicated.
And so how did Sierra Leone as a colony, and also probably the remnant of the Sierra Leone company back in London, benefit from this judicial instrument, this particular a new judicial instrument, right, that the Vice Admiralty Courts?
So the key figure, I argue, in Freedom Stutters in the Vice Admiralty Court is a man named Zachary Macaulay, who is, deserves, has been, I think there have been a number of biographies written of Macaulay, and I don't think, I think there's space for more, because Zachary Macaulay, I think, is a fascinating and complicated figure. Macaulay is a Scots, is a Scot, originally begins his career as a what's called a bookkeeper, which is a very kind of banal term for a plantation manager in the West Indies. And Macaulay claims that in the course of his time, or claim Macaulay claimed that in the course of his time in the West Indies, acting as the bookkeeper on a sugar plantation in Jamaica, he had become disgusted by the institution of slavery and had a kind of religious conversion. I'm not sure about that. In fact, it seems as though he had some kind of trouble with his employer, and he ended up back in London, where he happened to cross paths with the Babington family. Thomas Babington, who was a close friend of William Wilberforce and one of the wealthiest of the, not a significant theorist of anti-slavery, but a significant patron of anti-slavery, took Macaulay under his wing. And Macaulay converted, became a kind of a fervent evangelical, and became part of this circle of British evangelicals that included Wilberforce and Clarkson and Babington. And all of a sudden, Macaulay, who had been sort of one of thousands and thousands of middle-class Scots who went to make their fortune in the wider British Empire, all of a sudden he was kind of at the center of power, or at least of evangelical power in London. And he became eventually the governor of company of the company in Sierra Leone. And so all of that is preamble to the rise of Zachary Macaulay as the single most important figure in early Freetown. Although he left Freetown in 1799 and lived in London basically until he died. Macaulay and Babington, which was the name of Macaulay's trading firm, became the most important merchant firm in Sierra Leone. And the instrument that made them powerful was the Vice Admiralty Court. So every time a ship arrived in Sierra Leone, it would arrive in the Vice Admiralty Court. And it sort of arriving in the Vice Admiralty Court makes it seem much grander than it actually was, because the Vice Admiralty Court could sit basically anywhere. And that's something that we need to think about, I think, thinking about British imperial jurisprudence more broadly. You think about the Vice Admiralty Court as being, you know, a kind of grand building in Freetown. But, you know, wherever the Vice Admiralty judge was, he could convene the Vice Admiralty Court. So when ships arrived in Freetown, they were put into port. Any enslaved people on board were brought on shore. And then within a few years of 1807, a new colonial department called the Department of Captured Negroes, or the Captured Negro Department, had come into existence. And the officials of the Captured Negro Department would take a census of any enslaved people on board and, in a sense, officially declare them to be free. But they were kept in Freetown for the duration of the judicial proceedings against the ship on which they had on which they had been imprisoned. And so the ship would be appraised. It would be officially condemned by the Court of Vice Admiralty. All the stuff on board would also be condemned, and it would be offered at auction to anyone who could. The ship itself and any of the goods on board would be auctioned off. And Macaulay and Babington, Macaulay's firm, dominated every step of the process. So they were the most prominent merchants in Freetown. They had the most capital. They could buy and sell with, you know, relative ease, captured slave ships, and made quite a good business buying, refurbishing, and reselling captured slave ships to local merchants. They acted as wholesalers, so they would sell goods and food to Royal Navy ships that happened to be visiting the port after making a capture. They would sell goods and food to merchants. They employed most of the court, Vice Admiralty Court's officials. So it's the various advocates and marshals of the court were usually also employees of Macaulay and Babington. And so in a sense, the court and Macaulay's firm became so deeply interconnected with one another that I find it hard to think of them really as independent instruments. And Macaulay made a lot of money from the Vice Admiralty Court and from his other business, from his other trading concerns. But Sierra Leone, as he put it, right, he said, Sierra Leone, that is our place. He wrote in a letter to, I think to his nephew, if I remember correctly. And in many ways, for the duration of the Napoleonic Wars, you know, Sierra Leone was, economically speaking, Zachary Macaulay's possession. And so the Vice Admiralty Court became this engine of economic activity and a center of political gravity within the colony.
As you say, it's a center of commerce, but what happens to these so-called captured Africans?
Right. So it's interesting. What happens at first in the course of the Napoleonic Wars is very little, because there's a lot more money to be made from, you know, from 1808, when Sierra Leone becomes a crown colony and when the Court of Vice Admiralty is embodied, until, you know, the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. Although, as we can maybe talk about in a few minutes, in Sierra Leone, the Napoleonic Wars didn't really end until 1817, because that's when the British government started to crack down on wartime practices of search and seizure at sea. But enslaved people didn't really matter that much to the colony at first. We don't really even have a clear sense of how many people were released from slave ships at the time. I mean, we have a clear sense of how many people, there are incredible records at the National Archives in Kew that list the people captured on board slave ships in the period, but we have no sense of what happened to them. So for example, there was a colonial census taken in 1811, and it doesn't include people outside of Freetown proper. And so the population of Freetown hadn't really grown significantly from when the last census had been taken. But of course, thousands and thousands of former slaves had arrived in the colony. And it seems as though, for the most part, they were sent to live outside of the borders of Freetown proper. Some may have returned if they happened to be from places near the colony. Some may have returned home. Some were set up in kind of nominal settlements, but for the most part, their value to the colony was limited. So the first waves of people to arrive from 1809, 1810, were extremely valuable within Freetown proper, because everyone in Freetown wanted domestic labor. Those first groups of slave ships that arrived in Freetown provided a source of cheap labor for colonists and merchants within the colony proper. But Freetown was a very small town, right? There were no more than, you know, fewer than 10,000 colonists in 1810, significantly fewer. And so the demand for local labor became what was satisfied fairly quickly. And then the question was, well, what do you do with these people? And the answer was, I argue, kind of send them out of sight, out of mind. And it was only really after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, as we can talk about in a second, that the people who were known by the in the terms of the Vice Admiralty Court as captured Negroes became important to the colony. What mattered was slave ships. So, you know, that those first generations of enslaved people freed from slave ships and repatriated in Sierra Leone, we don't know that much about them. So, for example, the African-American merchant, Paul Cuff, who visited Sierra Leone a couple of times and who had schemes to kind of unite free African-Americans in the Northeast in the United States with colonists in Freetown, took a tour with a few prominent African-American colonists in Sierra Leone. And he went outside of the city to see some of the settlements occupied by former slaves. But in Freetown proper, he doesn't mention meeting a single former slave, right? He doesn't mention meeting anyone who had been freed from a slave ship. So I have this sense of the colony at the time as sort of having satisfied its own need for servants, sending out everyone else. And they only became important to the colony later.
Hmm. So much of anti-slavery up to then really seems to be based on war. It really depends. It really seems to have depended on the context of war. So what happens with the end of the Napoleonic Wars? How does anti-slavery change?
Right. So one of the things that is really was overlooked for a long time, I think, in the history of British anti-slavery was the significance of two wars, I think, to the trajectory of British anti-slavery. And the first is the Haitian Revolution, mm-hmm. which put a significant check, especially on Wilberforce. It terrorized Wilberforce, the idea of the sequel to the end of the slave trade or the end of slavery being the overthrow of British power in the Caribbean was something that Wilberforce couldn't countenance. Mm. And so that put a significant check on parliamentary anti-slavery. And the other is the Napoleonic War, the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars. So the initial abolition of slavery in the Revolutionary French Empire also checked British anti-slavery because one of the great tropes of, you know, the 1790s in British history is the interplay between British liberty and what most Britons would have called French license. So Britons are free and enjoy British liberty, but liberty is very structured. It is deliberate. It's in many ways conservative. Mm. Whereas the French are licentious, right? They can do whatever they like, but their freedom is without any constraint, and so therefore is basically valueless. It's just chaos or anarchy. Mm. And so when the French abolish slavery in the Revolutionary Empire, that also puts the brakes on British anti-slavery. But when Napoleon in 1804 reestablishes slavery in the French Empire, that suddenly gives the abolitionists a new way of arguing for the merits of the end of the slave trade, right? It becomes something that can be integrated into a patriotic war with France. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to overlook. It's one of those things that hides in plain sight. But the 1807 Slave Trade Act is wartime legislation. Mm. It uses a wartime instrument of search and seizure to advance a war aim, right? Which is the curbing French shipping and opposing France in every possible way on every possible front. And so the end of the Napoleonic Wars really is a crisis for British anti-slavery. And it's a crisis for Sierra Leone in particular. So it becomes difficult after the end of the war with France to figure out exactly you know, how Britain can continue to carry on its campaign against the slave trade. Because one of the things I point out in Freedom's Debtors is that a lot of the slave ships captured in Sierra Leone weren't, like, the 1807 Slave Trade Act was supposed to apply only to British ships and to enemy ships, right? It was supposed to be, it made it illegal for Britons to trade in slaves, and it made foreign belligerent slave ships into a lawful prize that British ships could capture. But in Sierra Leone, most of the ships captured were Spanish and Portuguese owned. And the Spanish and the Portuguese were, Portugal were Britain's allies in the war against France. So the campaign against the slave trade in Sierra Leone was carried out at the expense of Britain's allies. And after the end of, and in the course of the Napoleonic Wars, you know, the Portuguese monarchy only survived the Napoleonic Wars because of British aid. Spain was, you know, it was a campaign of British forces and Spanish partisans that drove the French out of the Iberian Peninsula. Neither Spain nor Portugal was in a position to really complain about British captures of its ships. But after 1815, that changed. And all of a sudden, both Spain and Portugal, A, refused to countenance refused to give up their own slave trades. So after 1815, Britain capitulated and allowed the slave trade to continue south of the line, so south of the equator, legally, under the Spanish and Portuguese flags. And Spain and Portugal both wanted restitution for all of the slave ships that had been captured in the course of the Napoleonic Wars, particularly in Sierra Leone. So all of a sudden, Britain's erstwhile allies wanted payback for what Britain had taken from them in the course of its campaign against the slave trade. And it was made very clear to Royal Navy ships that they could no longer pursue slave ships with the kind of impunity that they had done during the Napoleonic Wars. And in Sierra Leone, that was a crisis, because the Vice Admiralty Court had become so central to the colony's economic survival that the end of the slave trade entailed, you know, that the end of the campaign against the slave trade, as it had been carried out in wartime, meant the possibility of ruin for the colony, and the kind of end of its economic life. And so it was a crisis. And the question in Sierra Leone became, well, what do we do now that slave ships are no longer valuable or as valuable as they had been? What do we do? How can we survive? How can this colony continue to survive?
And that's, I suppose, that's when sort of your final chapter talks about the Liberated African Department and how, and that shift in the governance of Sierra Leone from slave ships to the African communities, the liberated Africans.
So the kind of high point, it's worth sort of cycling back. So the kind of high point of the campaign against the slave trade in Sierra Leone, I argue in the book, was right on the eve of the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when a governor named Charles Maxwell, who I think quite kind of shrewdly understood the sort of kind of gave a transparent account of the logic of the Vice Admiralty Court when he started to not only attack slave ships at sea, but also use his own, the unit of soldiers that he controlled, the Royal African Corps, which included both enslaved people, formerly enslaved people, and white convicts, and used them to attack slave forts on the coast of West Africa. And by doing that, they could claim the property of the forts through the Vice Admiralty Court, and also through the Vice Admiralty Court, claim formerly enslaved people as soldiers for the Royal African Corps. So Maxwell understood, saw anti-slavery as this kind of military, economic military perpetual motion machine, that once he imagined that once he set it in motion, he could indefinitely continue to grow his own unit, the Royal African Corps, and also continue to seize more and more prize money for his own and his officers in Richmond. And Maxwell was actually the first governor of Sierra Leone to be sued by a slave trader, which is an important segue. He was sued and I think the British government eventually settled for something like four. It was a significant settlement. I I mean, I might be off by a factor of 10. It's either, I want to say 40,000 pounds, but that seems, anyway, the British government eventually had to bail out Maxwell with a significant settlement paid to an American citizen who was a slave trader, which is just goes to show that you couldn't, as a British governor in Sierra Leone, you could no longer seize slave ships the way you had done after 1815. And so Governor Charles McCarthy, and the original title of the book, which I think to the editors at Yale's credit was McCarthy's Skull, which is a little bit obscure on the shelf. Although if you read the book, you can see that McCarthy's beheading at the hands of the Ashanti, which maybe we can talk about at the end, is important, I think, symbolically for the history of the colonial history of Sierra Leone. But Charles McCarthy was a very, very gifted administrator. It's not clear whether or not he was a particularly gifted soldier because he had been born in France. So Charles McCarthy was born Charles Guérou, and spoke with a French accent, had been raised in France as the descendant of Jacobites who had joined the French army after the end of the Stuart monarchy in Britain. And so McCarthy was very, very, I think had McCarthy not been a French Catholic, although he was a British subject, he might have been risen to a significant administrative position within the British Army because he was very good at organizing. But he spent his entire career at a series of military backwaters. So he was the organizer of recruiting in New Brunswick, which was not a teeming metropolis in the 1700s. And then he eventually ended up, he got his first significant command in Senegal and then in Gorée on the coast of West Africa. So these were not places that were considered strategically deeply significant to the British government. And McCarthy became governor of Sierra Leone in 1814 and had the perspicacity to understand that the end of the Napoleonic Wars meant that Sierra Leone's structure of colonial government would have to change and change quickly if the colony was going to continue to exist. And so he took, as the Vice Admiralty Court waned in importance and was eventually replaced by courts called the Courts of Mixed Commission, which I think significantly were bilateral courts. So every court of mixed commission, they operated roughly the same way as the Vice Admiralty Courts, in the sense that captured slave ships would be brought to Freetown, they would be condemned by the Court of Mixed Commission, and then everything would be sold at auction and the proceeds distributed. But where the Vice Admiralty Court distributed most of the proceeds directly to British captains, the Courts of Mixed Commission would reserve a portion for the foreign government that was involved in the court. So a Portuguese ship, you know, Portugal would get half the proceeds of the sale, and the other half would have to be sent back to England to be distributed from Britain proper rather than in the colony itself. So the Courts of Mixed Commission kept turning slave ships into money, but none of the money was going, or very little of the money was going to Sierra Leone. And so McCarthy grasped that people freed from slave ships could replace slave ships themselves as the center of the colonial government. So he focused his energy on reforming what had been called the Captured Negro Department, and which he, in, I think, sometime in 1820 or 1821, renamed the Liberated African Department in a kind of imperial rebranding. So these were no longer captured Negroes. They were no longer enslaved people who were still property, but property without an owner. They were liberated Africans. And in his hands, the Liberated African Department became a way of preserving Sierra Leone as a functioning colony for a few more years. So the Liberated African Department became the center, I argue, of the colonial government, replacing the Vice Admiralty Court.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, let's finally go back to Macaulay's Skull. I mean, so you frame your book you begin and you end with, sorry, not Macaulay, have I got it right?
McCarthy,
apologies. McCarthy. Too many people with surnames.
There's a lot of.
So what is the after story of McCarthy's skull? Because it comes to have an important role in an important symbolic role in British imperial culture.
Yeah, I mean it's worth just quickly. I'll just quickly explain what the Liberated African Department did and how McCarthy came to be. Mm-hmm. How it made, in many ways, it made McCarthy into an important. It finally scrubbed clean his French Catholicism and made him into a Knight of the Realm. And so the Liberated African Department was organized. It had, I guess I would divide it into, it had a kind of religious mission and it had an economic mission. And its religious mission was to take former slaves, liberated Africans, and turn them into something as close as possible to, as closely resembling British English speaking Christians as could be managed within the colonial government. And constrained by all of the imagined limitations of all of the limitations on cultural life that Britons imagined were sort of inhered in Africans, in West Africans. So McCarthy established a series of villages that were not far from Freetown, but geographically remote from Freetown. So a lot of them were in the mountains above the city. Above the town, a lot of them were along the coast, sort of away. So Freetown sits on a large natural harbor, but the liberated African villages were up and down the coasts to the north and south of Freetown and in the mountains. And so as people arrived from slave ships, they were distributed. Sometimes, it seems to me, often, at least in this period, kind of arbitrarily to villages. And the villages all had patriotic names. So Wilberforce and York and Regent and a number of others, Waterloo. And in the villages, they were subject to they were under the administration of missionaries appointed by the Church Missionary Society, what became the Church Missionary Society. In the villages proper, effectively, McCarthy made a kind of bargain with the Church Missionary Society. If they would turn, he would allow them access to liberated Africans as potential converts, provided they would also take on a lot of the responsibilities of administering the villages, which is, I think, it shows McCarthy's acumen as administrator that he was able to effectively recruit for very, very little money, village administrators to run his colony for him in exchange for the right to evangelize. And so the liberated African villages were supposed to be places where former slaves would become Christians and would learn all of the virtues of British Christianity. Although in practice, most of the missionaries were actually German Moravians, which is another wrinkle in the story. And then the economic mission of the villages was that in addition to learning the virtues of British Christianity, former slaves would also learn the virtues of wage labor, which circles back to the original purpose of the colony and the original scheme of the Sierra Leone Company to have African Americans learn how to work. I put that in inverted commas, to have African Americans work for wages and internalize somehow the not only the idea of exchanging their labor for money, but also to really want to exchange their labor for money and to want to save their money and buy property and become British, sort of British peasant bourgeois, a kind of British peasant bourgeoisie. And so in the liberated African villages, McCarthy had this vision of British Christians making money, growing crops, buying land, and turning into a kind of yeomanry of Africa. And in some sense, this the Liberated African Department, the archives don't say much about the experiences of liberated Africans in this period. So a lot of what I do in the book is speculate based on very sketchy evidence about what the experience, the lived experience of village life would have actually been like for formerly enslaved people, and for local people who are suddenly interacting with liberated Africans from all across the coast of West Africa. But what the liberated African villages are very good at is attracting publicity in Britain, and attracting goods and services and discounts and special sort of special pleading. They're an excellent way for McCarthy to make pleas for his colony in London, because they are they seem to represent exactly what Britain wanted from former slaves, right? The idea that former slaves would continue to serve white overseers peacefully, nonviolently, would not resist, and would work to try to become more and more like Britons. Now, that's not actually what happened, but that's McCarthy was very good at making it seem like that's what was happening. And so he became incredibly, I mean, within the limited constraints of what was possible within West African colonial governance at the time, McCarthy became very successful. He was knighted. He became General Sir Charles McCarthy, and eventually he became General Sir Charles McCarthy, Governor-in-Chief of Britain's West African possessions. So McCarthy lobbied for all of the other scattering of little settlements and trading posts that Britain controlled or nominally controlled on the course of West Africa, and they were all folded under his governorship in Sierra Leone. And eventually, he was named in 1822, although, I mean, I wrote the book, I should probably know this, but he was, as Britain's, the Royal African Company, which eventually then became the Company of Merchants Trading to Africa, this old, venerable slave trading company, the began to collapse in the wake of the end of the abolition of the slave trade. And they had controlled a series of forts in what's now Ghana, then the Gold Coast. And McCarthy was named governor of the Gold Coast, as well as, or rather, the government of the Gold Coast was folded into the government of Sierra Leone. And all of a sudden, McCarthy was nominally the governor of a coastline that was hundreds and hundreds of miles long, and the series of tiny settlements along the coast. And then McCarthy personally traveled to, there was a dispute in the Gold Coast between the Kingdom of Ashanti, which was the sort of by far the most powerful regional kingdom, a very significant power in West Africa. And the coastal alliance between British traders and Fante villagers. And McCarthy journeyed to the Gold Coast and believed that his success in Sierra Leone had made him invulnerable in dealing with West African kingdoms. And he pulled Britain into a war with the Ashanti Empire, the first Anglo-Ashanti War of, I think it was, I guess, 1823 to 1827, although I might be incorrect about that. And McCarthy also opted to personally lead a detachment of troops, and he was ambushed on the Pra River, which eventually became the unofficial border between British territory and Ashanti territory. At the end of the Anglo-Ashanti War, his troops were ambushed by a group of Ashanti soldiers. And after an entire night of gunfire, eventually the Ashanti forded the river and massacred the British Infante troops and beheaded McCarthy, allegedly. They actually did behead McCarthy. And so McCarthy's private secretary, who was taken as a hostage by the Ashanti and was and was eventually ransomed, woke up the next morning after losing consciousness in, at the end of the battle, he says, next to the headless corpse of Charles McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And McCarthy's skull became this symbol of British gallantry and a kind of imagined West African, especially Ashanti savagery. So it was believed that the skull was used as a trophy by the Ashantahene, the king of Ashanti. It was believed that it was sort of worshipped as a trophy. The skull has this kind of strange mythical history, and no one really knows what actually happened to the skull. But McCarthy's skull became this symbol of the sacrifice that Britain had made and in the course of the 19th century continued to believe itself to be making on behalf of the project of civilizing West Africa.
Right. Well, Patrick, we've taken up a lot of your time. As a last question, can I ask you what you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. So as I kind of hinted in the last question, I think that what we can take away from the colonial history of Sierra Leone is that it marks a moment where anti-slavery turned into the kind of great project of anti-slavery in the British Empire began to turn into a project of a civilizing mission and a kind of new way of thinking about colonialism as a project of taking the lives of imperial subjects and remaking their economic, political, religious, and cultural lives in a way that would slowly transform them into British subjects, right? So that civilizing mission, I think, has its roots in British anti-slavery. And I think you can see very clearly the connection between anti-slavery and the civilizing mission in Sierra Leone. And so right now I'm working on a project that pushes these questions of emancipation and the civilizing mission forward into the 19th century and looks more specifically at the doing of emancipation in the West Indies. So I'm working on a couple of articles about the transition from slavery to freedom in the West Indies in the 1820s and 1830s. And more broadly, I'm looking at the idea of emancipation as something that helped to organize the British Empire more broadly in the 19th century. I think for a long time, historians have thought about the kind of early Victorian free trading British Empire, the Empire of Reform, the Great Reform Act, the end of the Poor Law, as being something that was fundamentally a kind of domestic reform that then redounded on the empire. But I'm hoping to argue in my next project that, in fact, emancipation and ideas about emancipation and ideas about freedom were brought to Britain from the Caribbean and from West Africa. They're ideas from an Atlantic world where, to paraphrase Rebecca Scott, you know, the line between slavery and freedom is paper thin. And I think that idea has deep roots and unacknowledged roots in the history of Britain in, you know, the first three decades of the 19th century. So what that project is going to look like, I'm not sure at this point in time, but that's really what I've been digging away at.
Well, that sounds like quite an exciting and really needed and necessary project. Thank you so much for being on the show, Patrick. It was a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So take care.